Our first guest this morning is Micah Solomon, author of Ignore Your Customers and They'll Go Away. Thanks for joining us, Micah, and good morning.
Good morning. It's snowy here, too. I'm right outside Seattle, but I'm sure it's not like yours.
I actually understand you had a little power problem this morning.
So the problem with people with all-wheel drives, and I'm not naming you as a name, is that you don't understand that it doesn't help you stop.
But the fancy snow tires are supposed to. Anyway.
Well, good tires are a good thing.
So, Micah, tell us a little bit about what motivated you to write this book, which, by the way, I found compelling because not only do you express some great concepts, but you illustrate them with examples, and I'll be asking you more about those examples as we go along. But like I said, what compels you to write the book?
Well, customer service is today's marketing. In the Mad Men era, you could hire Don Draper or Peggy Olson or their real-life equivalent. Some brilliant marketer, they'd write good ad copy, and your product would sell, even if it was good, mediocre, or it was lucky strikes and it would literally kill you. But today it's not like that. Customers only believe traditional marketing like that if it aligns with what they've experienced with your company or what their friends and the people they trust online have experienced. So with customers being in charge, the quality of your customer service and the connections you make with your customers are the ultimate in advertising for you. They can kill your business or they can elevate it without spending really a lot of money other than the $20 approximately that it would cost to buy my book.
Now, you mentioned that, you know, customers are in charge. Has that changed?
It has. It hasn't. I mean, if you had a small store in a community and everyone knew you were so horrible that they had to drive elsewhere, yes, then they were in charge. But as far as today, there are so many options in almost every industry. And when customers know something great about you, they can spread it so quickly with what I call word of thumb marketing, with digital social marketing. So yes, I would say they're more in charge than they ever have been before.
The first substantive chapter of the book is called Automatic Positivity. And let's talk a little bit about what that concept means. And of course, can you give us an example that demonstrates how it can be implemented?
So automatic positivity is a highfalutin way of saying building a culture of yes. So when you walk into a Nordstrom, do you have a Nordstrom in Park City?
There is one in Salt Lake.
Yeah.
Okay, so listen, you need to buy $1,000 suit so you can test my proposition here. But when you walk into Nordstrom, you'll have two impressions. One is probably, I'm going to pay a lot for this suit because the place is so beautiful, right? But the other impression is these people really want to help me. They want to get to yes. They don't care what my question is. They're going to find a way to solve it. So that is a culture of yes. An example I give in the book is with Zappos, where they will talk with you on the phone as long as it takes. I listen in on a woman named Madison who's in their contact center. And the woman who calls is an older woman who's really frustrated because she couldn't find shoes in narrow that were comfortable enough to wear all day at her daughter's or maybe granddaughter's wedding. So Madison bonds over that. She says, oh, narrow feet are the worst. I talk with my aunt about her narrow feet and her complaints about that. I would say every other time we talk. So then they're best friends, and the woman understands that Madison is going to figure this out for me. And in fact, they go online, they find some likely candidates to get her through the wedding, and it's wonderful.
And the concept of getting to yes, what was interesting in the chapter to me was, obviously, you know, someone says, I want free everything. There are certain things you cannot say yes to. But what I got from the book was the notion of finding something that can be positive rather than saying, it's not our policy, we won't do that.
So that's exactly right. So I am a customer service consultant, which means I help everyone from retail stores to five-star hotels and resorts to improve their customer service. That is an actual rule that you just brought up for five-star hotels. Never say no to a guest without offering one or two reasonable alternatives. So a customer says, I want to have breakfast in your dining room, but it's 12:30, 1 o'clock. It's right when they're setting up for lunch, and they have to be closed. So a reasonable alternative might be, we will serve you out here on the veranda. It just helps a lot because you're not just saying no. I'm glad you brought up the opportunity to not say no. These are privacy, security, or safety related. So you don't want to automatically, did I say not say no? Not say yes. So these are times when you can't automatically say yes. Very nice companies have revealed their password to hackers over the phone because they were trying to get the yes. So, right, and it's true. I mean, one of those was Apple, which is a very nice customer service company, but they got, right, so that's one. You know, over service at a bar, you know, yeah, you can drink until you're a catatonic. Not a good one either. Of course, sir, you can push your seat up to block our fire exit. That's not a good automatic yes either. All true examples, by the way, unfortunately.
No, I completely understand. So when you gave the example of being able to dine on the veranda, the person that's really doing the customer service and facing, you know, the customer or the guest would be that server, whomever they're talking to. But serving breakfast may include more people than just that person speaking with the guest. How do you bring everyone in, people from the kitchen, you know, or, you know, busing staff? You know, this may be an extra task for them. How do you work that?
So the first thing is you need to build in what I call breathing space into your operation. So the only reason that Madison at Zappos was able to spend extra time on the phone is because they are slightly, quote unquote, overstaffed. So they have the flexibility to have a phone call go longer. And the same thing is true at a 5-star hotel. You need to have enough staff so that they can flex for this customer with this challenging request. I think the first challenge there, or what you brought up, is to even get the server on board with this. And that only happens because the leadership says, you are empowered to do this. And not just that, but it's your job to take the empowerment we give you and be creative with it. As far as the kitchen, that's a great example. And I quote, you know, the fantastic, he's a great guy, celebrity chef, Tom Colicchio from Top Chef. And he says that is one of his challenges because in the example, if someone wants a substitution in their in what they're getting for their meal, and the server can be so scared to go back and tell the chef, and the chef might say, no, I'm not going to do that. Get out of here. So in Tom Colicchio's kitchen, he says, you know, if a chef ever cops that kind of attitude, he says, okay, well, you tell the customer.
One of the things you talked about just there was the concept of breathing space, but that seems to me to be just one element of sort of building an overall customer service culture. Talk a little bit about how that's done and some examples of where we've really seen that demonstrated.
So I spend the chapter on creating a customer service culture, or you might call it a customer-centered culture. So this has to start, or I think it has to start, with a statement of purpose. And a bad statement of purpose is 3 pages long. You wrote it on your company retreat. Everyone had a great time there. Everyone added their 2 cents. All of the 2 cents were put into it. So you end up with this 3-page document with lots of jargon and lots of constituencies within the company being represented. Problem with that is, I mean, I love that you had a great retreat, but something that long and unwieldy is just going to end up in the CEO's desk and gather dust. What you want is something really short, really memorable. So a great one is the Mayo Clinic, the needs of the patient come first. It's only 7 words. Only one of them goes beyond one syllable, and that's very actionable. Famous ones for the Ritz-Carlton, we are ladies and gentlemen serving ladies and gentlemen. It tells you that how you're going to treat the guests, but also how you expect to be treated by your coworkers. So you get this statement of purpose. Then you infuse it in everything. And as you brought up, this is easier said than done. So this means infusing it into your hiring practices, into your onboarding practices, even in your daily ritual. So the Ritz-Carlton Hotel Company, which is an amazing example, they started with, I think, 4 hotels, and now they have over 100, and they all very closely, or is as close as a global brand can be, are still aligned. Well, how do they do that? Well, they have a 10-minute meeting every morning on one of these principles. They also have collateral, and it sounds a little corny, but they've been doing this since the 80s. They have an accordion card. It's laminated so it doesn't get all beat up. And everyone can carry it in their pocket, and it has their core principles, including their statement of purpose. So you're infusing this in everything. Then you have to have the breathing space that we talked about. Because if you go out of your way for a customer, at the end of the day, you may get fewer light bulbs changed or whatever was on your checklist of things to do that day. At the Ritz-Carlton, you'll be celebrated for that. At other companies, you'll just get a really hard time for it. So it needs to infuse the culture, which is easier said than done. And then the last thing, which really carries you over the finish line, is what I call positive peer pressure. So do you have an Apple store in the – you must have an Apple store. You guys are very tech forward,
right? In the area, for sure.
Yeah. So, again, you can try this. I think you need to buy a $1,000 iPad to test this. Or you could get their new $5,000 cinema display. So you need to test this. But you walk in there, and the people are very eager to serve you. So how does that happen? Well, number one, they hired right. Number two – they actually went to hospitality training, the kind of things I'm recommending. They went to hospitality training and then adapted some of these great principles for their own brand. Number three, did I say hired right? Yeah, they hired right, they trained right, and then the positive peer pressure carries them over the finish line, because you know that if you work at the Apple store, the way things are done around here is to be enthusiastic, be knowledgeable about the technology, but to always take a customer view from that. You're going to get them, the customer, where they need to go, whether or not it makes Apple any money at the moment. I walked into our Apple store here in Seattle. I had my iPhone, and it wouldn't charge. Now, you know, I'm a guy, and I think I know about technology, and I walk in there, and I say, I think it needs a new software update or blah, blah, blah. And the young woman who helped me, she didn't say, no, you're wrong. She said, yeah, you're probably right, as I kept mansplaining to her. Yeah, that's probably, it's probably something complicated. But while she was saying yes to me, she had this custom-made tool that was cleaning out the connection on my phone. And after she got all this gunk out of there and lint and hair from our four dogs, which is true, we have four dogs, a cat and a goldfish, and the only one of them without hair is a goldfish, she said, well, try it now. So I plug it in, it charges perfectly. So she said, I don't want to be sexist, but it's usually dudes who get their phones all jammed up like this because women carry them in their purse, but you put it in your pocket. She was absolutely right. She never said no to me except with the kind of joke at the end. And so she knows to do that partly because she's well-trained and partly because she's seen her coworkers do that. So that is the happy thing that I call positive peer pressure, and it's a great culture-building success.
Absolutely. And really, as you said, it's the long game. You may not make another purchase, but you remember the experience. When a company's looking at just starting to institute these practices, one, you know, they're not a new employee coming in surrounded by other employees,
right?
You know, modeling that type of behavior. How do you work through kind of that organizational resistance, maybe in the beginning?
So that's exactly right. You can't start with all new employees. I mean, unless you're Kendall on a succession and he fires everyone at Bolton. Most of us would not want to do that, right? Would not want to do that. So you're starting with the people that you have. So they need to see these words on the paper, this purpose that you've crafted. But then they need to see that you mean it. They need to see the CEO serving customers, not hiding back in their office. They need to have a reminder every day, if possible, in your culture, if you can do what I call a customer service minute at the beginning of the day, up to 10 minutes. I don't want it to be longer than 10, because then it just becomes another meeting, and we all don't need another meeting. So in those up to 10 minutes, you talk about one of these customer service principles. You celebrate the people who brought that to life in the last couple weeks. You also commiserate about when it was challenging to do that. Sometimes it's great to talk about stories where things went wrong and learn how a coworker would have handled that better. And then you start to reward good behavior. Now, I pretty much don't mean contests and paying little bonuses. I think that stuff works, but I also think employees are smarter than their bosses by and large, and they will learn to game that stuff faster than you can blink. I mean more like who is treated, who gets the pat on the back in the company. At the Ritz-Carlton, it's the people who did fantastic things for their customers. They share these stories. They call them stories of wow. And everyone understands that this is the way to do things here. Now, not everyone's going to get with the program. The founder of Four Seasons, a wonderful gentleman named Isidore Sharp, says that when he made the principles of Four Seasons, when he changed them, it was a few years into the process. They started out as, if you can believe this, the Ritz-Carlton Motor Hotel. They only had one hotel. But when they expanded and they decided they were going to do ultra luxury, he made these four principles that were very customer-centered and also, by the way, very employee-centered. And this was a few years ago. He says he can still hear the sound of all the faxes that went out there, of all the executives who really didn't want to get with the new program. They wanted to be with the old rigid style. So sometimes people are going to leave if they're not interested in doing it the new way. That is a fact.
You know, we've talked about people leaving. We've talked about sort of implementing culture. What about, let's talk a little bit about hiring. In other words, if what you want to do is create this kind of customer-centric culture, how do you look for that in an employee? How do you look for that in the onboarding process?
The nice thing is that word of mouth is going to get out about your company. So Mayo Clinic, you can apply if you don't have the right mindset, but you probably won't, because everybody knows that Mayo Clinic practices collaborative medicine. You have to be a team player to work there successfully. So the word of mouth is a good thing, and word of mouth spreads more quickly now with Glassdoor and so forth. But as far as how to hire, what you need to do is to stop hiring just on what I would call technical skills. Those can still be important and very important in certain businesses, certain positions. But you also need to hire for what I would call personality traits. The problem with personality traits is that by the time we reach our 20s, maybe our mid-20s, these are usually locked down for most people. Now, there are fantastic exceptions, so I don't want to overestimate this. So how do you figure out? Well, first you got to figure out what the traits are that you want, the customer-facing traits. And then you need to figure out how to hire for them. So it's two different issues. Now, I can tell you in very broad strokes what the customer-centric traits are. Are you ready? I want you to picture a big, wet dog outside of Petco. So it's big, it's wet, and it's outside of Petco. Now, you'll never forget my principles because there's five of them, and they spell WETCO, WETCO. So these are, in very broad strokes, what you're looking for in a new employee.
So
W is warmth. This simply means liking other people. Like, your default is you like other people. E is empathy. That's more involved. That is sensing what someone else is wanting or thinking or desiring before they even express it. Kind of like a magic trick, but some people have this ability. T is teamwork. Like I was talking about the Mayo Clinic, you need to be team-oriented. You need to be willing to involve your team members to get a solution for a customer. C is conscientiousness. This means detail-orientedness. So even if you're empathetic, you're warm, you're a team player, and you tell, oh, Mrs. Smith, I totally understand what you're saying. Oh, I've been there too. Oh, my goodness. I'm going to get this solved with the help of my team, and I'm going to call you back Thursday. Is that good? Now, this happened with a finance company the other day for me. They were totally like that, but they were going to call me back Friday, and they didn't. So that means you don't have conscientiousness, and you're not probably going to be helpful to the customer in the end. And the last one is optimism. By this, I mean an optimistic explanatory style. Customers bless their hearts, but sometimes they will bite your head off. So what can you do? Well, you can think, that's terrible. I must have done a horrible thing. I'm not cut out for it. Go to bed, pull the covers over your head, never go to work again. Or you can think, well, you know, maybe I could have done better on that call, but I think they were having a hard day. I'm going to dust myself off and take the next call. So that's called an optimistic explanatory style. Now, these are very broad strokes, a WETCO, warmth, empathy, teamwork, conscientiousness, and optimism. To get beyond the broad strokes, you should really hire a company like Gallup or one of these companies that is very scientifically can help you hire for these traits. But if you want to try it on your own, those are rules of thumb. And just be aware that there are also equal opportunity rules as well that you need to be careful about and that are very important, and I embrace those. So whether they're covered by WETCO or not, you're going to have to do a little more research on.
Absolutely. Well, one last question to wrap up our discussion today. When people look to implement this in their business, it does appear that there is a good amount of time to be able to get everyone on board, to be able to put those practices in place. What's the return? What's the benefit that these businesses are going to see?
The return is that customers will spread this word of mouth for you. They will become your marketing ambassadors. It's very, very powerful. The other thing to remember is that every customer is irreplaceable. I don't even like to think of customers in the plural. The only customer is the one in front of you. And if you can delight the customer in front of you, they will tell everybody else about you, and you'll have a much easier job. People still love the old style marketing, but studies show that they tend to believe it if their experience with your company is a good one. And it tends to just be taken ironically if you treat them otherwise. So this is the big payoff, is that they are going to sustain your company indefinitely.
Thank you so much, Micah. We've been talking with Micah Solomon, the author of Ignore Your Customers and They Will Go Away. We truly appreciate your time with us this morning. Thank you, and happy snowy weather in Seattle.
Yeah, I don't know if you would even call the snow, but we're enjoying it. Thank you guys so much. It's great that you actually read my book. That made my day. Thanks again.
Yes, have a good day. Bye-bye.